Hi, welcome to Musings with Monse, a podcast where I have meaningful conversations with all kinds of artists. Musicians, poets, photographers, and other creatives share their honest stories, touching on the duality of being creative, the pure joy of making art, but also the particular struggles that come with it.
And honey, there's no way that I'll ever know. Oh, everything about you, but oh, how I love what I do. And honey, I love what I don't know too.
In this episode, I'm talking to Sam Outlaw. He is a musician and one of my good friends. I love his story and how he took the risk of leaving a comfortable job to pursue his music full time. We also go real deep into mental health in this episode. He sums up what it feels like to go through panic attacks and waves of depression in one of the truest and most beautiful ways I've ever heard. I really appreciated Sam's openness and honesty, and I think you will too. Thanks for listening and enjoy.
It's what I don't know to, yeah.
It's Sam.
Hey, it's Monse.
Hi.
How's it going? Hey, Monse.
Going well. How are you?
I'm good. I feel like I haven't seen you in so long.
I know. When was the last time? I mean, it would have been when I played in San Francisco, like last summer. I think.
I was thinking that. I was trying to figure out. I feel like you played in San Francisco a number of times. And like,
well, I mean, the last time I would have been there was for Hardly Strictly, which is what, like basically a year ago.
I don't think I was here for that.
Yeah, you weren't there.
Yeah.
So it was my show either one of the last days of May, I think.
Yeah, that sounds right. It's just been too long. That's the point.
Way too long.
Okay, so to start off, just, you know, telling me a bit about your story in your own words, mm-hmm. you know, noting that you were actually, you haven't been, you know, professionally a musician for that long, even though it's hard to believe that, because it just feels like you've been doing it forever, at least from my
right.
perspective, you know, and ever since I've known you. But you started out in the digital advertising world, and I just would love to hear, in your words, you know, the moment that you just felt, you know, brave enough to just step into your truth and just made this happen for yourself.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I still feel like I'm waiting for that moment to come. I still feel like afraid and insecure on a regular basis. But I mean, yeah, I guess the story is, you know, when I was in high school, I started playing guitar and I would kind of dabble in songwriting and had a couple like little bands in high school. It was basically just like doing Oasis covers and, mm-hmm. you know, covering stuff that was on the radio, like in the late 90s. And then in college as well, I wrote songs and I had like kind of all my friends were musicians and I was always around that group. But I never really felt like this kind of tortured artist with much to say. And then when it was time to graduate college, it was kind of like, well, I love music and I love writing, but I don't know that I'm cut out to be like a proper like songwriter. Like, I don't know if I should just try moving to Nashville and being like a songwriter. So I decided, well, I like music, but I got a degree in business. Maybe I'll try out the music business. Mm-hmm. And this was in, you know, I was graduating college. I went to Cal Poly San Luis Obispo, and I was graduating college in 2004, which was right during, you know, obviously kind of a massive paradigm shift in the music industry.
Yep.
So it was right after Napster was happening, and the industry was completely in flux, trying to figure out what to do. So I started working at a small record label in Orange County called the Militia Group, which kind of started as kind of a pop punk label. And they had some bands that were outside of that genre, but they did well for themselves. And it was a good job because it was like, I was hired as like kind of like the warehouse manager / intern manager / online marketing guy / I mean, just everything. Like it was basically like I was the lowest man on the totem pole. So if anything went wrong, it would get blamed on me. If anything didn't work, it was my fault. And it was great. It was a great first job because you basically just get completely shit on the entire time and you have to learn how to do everything really quickly. So I started in the music industry and, you know, again, at that point was still kind of writing songs, but never really playing out. And then I went to Africa for a couple of months to help my friend with a music therapy project that she was doing, where she was working with kids that had been either rescued or escaped from the civil war in Uganda. Wow. So I went and did that and then came back and needed a job. And this company called IndieClick hired me to do promotions. And then like about a month into that job, they're like, hey, we don't want to sell promotions. So unless you want to be out of a job, we need you to learn how to sell advertising, which was their main business, was online advertising. And their main thing was selling it to the music industry. They kind of taught the music industry early on about, you know, how to buy banners and that kind of thing. So I got into digital advertising sales, and I stayed there for like, I mean, essentially a decade.
Wow.
I think it was like on my 30th birthday. I remember I was doing well. I was working for a different company by then, but I was doing well, making lots of money and kind of living this very cozy, yuppie bachelor life in Echo Park in East LA. So I was living in a nice kind of bachelor apartment in Angelino Heights, this really pretty Spanish fourplex overlooking downtown LA. So I threw myself this kind of like show-offy 30th birthday party with like, I rented out a bar in Silver Lake and had like bands play and like an open tab. And, you know, I got to show off like my cool new Audi. And I basically was just kind of, I guess, trying to, again, it wasn't like, I don't even think I was aware of it, but I was just trying to like show people a good time, but also like solidify in my own self, like all this work must mean something because I have nice things. So I remember I woke up the next day from my 30th birthday party I threw for myself. And I think I just felt kind of, I mean, not only did I feel obviously hungover, but I also felt just kind of like, I don't know, I just felt kind of empty from it. And not like in a anti-capitalism way. Like, I think money is great. I think making money is great. And some people, you know, all they can do is sort of like square jobs. And I think that's fine. But I think I just was like, you know, if I'm honest with myself, I do care about music and maybe I should try to like move towards that. So starting when I turned 30 years old, I don't think I ever like, I didn't make any like grand proclamations to myself, like I'm going to live my dreams or I'm going to face my fears or any of that shit. I think I just was like, I'm going to move a little bit closer in the general direction of what I think my dreams might be. Because that way there wasn't this like looming pressure to, you know, somehow become some sort of something within a year and then be devastated and feel like a failure when it doesn't happen. But I called up a buddy of mine who plays in a band called Delta Spirit, this guy Kelly Winrich, who's just a really talented multi-instrumentalist and producer and engineer and songwriter, and I told him I wanted to try to make a record. So long story short, we recorded together in San Clemente. I kind of self-released this LP, but I stayed at my job for another like 4 years.
Wow.
I think.
Yeah.
And it, you know, by that, I also put out another EP. I got like, right after I got married in 2014, like I was with my wife at our honeymoon in Savannah. And like the first night she's like, okay, so like we're on a honeymoon. So that means no work, no music stuff, no advertising stuff. Let's just, and then like that night at dinner, I got a call saying, or I got an email saying like, hey, it's last minute, but would you want to play Stagecoach this weekend?
Wow.
I was like, shit, yes, I would like to do that. So we ended up, we still stayed on our honeymoon. I think we ended up coming home like a day early or something. But last minute, someone dropped out. They asked some folks. I think they asked like Ed Helms and maybe Amy, who are at the Bluegrass Situation in LA, like if they could recommend anyone. And at least somewhere in that mix was me. So they reached out to me. I got to do that, which was cool. And then let's see. I mean, after that, again, I'm still working a job this entire time. So I was a full-time job this entire time, and then I think I went and finally played at like Nashville at like the Music City Roots showcase, and that was when things kind of started picking up. And I was introduced to Michelle Aquilotto, who at the time was kind of running Americana Music Association, producing the show. I started rehearsing a band and trying to hire people, and I knew I wanted to make like a proper record that would get a proper release, but I didn't know how to do it. So I called up my buddy Taylor Goldsmith from Dawes, and I asked him if he could kind of help me put people together, and he started helping with that. And I did know, though, that I wanted to hire Joaquin Cooter on drums. I'd met him a year earlier. He was touring with a friend of mine named Carly Ritter and played drums for her and produced her record. And so I called him up and asked him if he would want to maybe play on the record and do some rehearsing. So we started rehearsing with this band in my living room that included Joaquin. And like, he was asking me about the producer situation. I said, well, I don't have one. Do you have any ideas? And he's like, well, I think I'd like to send our rehearsal demos to my father, who is Ry Cooter. And I was just like, well, why? Like, what interest would this living guitar legend have in my like 3-minute pop songs? And he's like, I don't know, but I think these songs are cool, so let me just send them to him and see what happens. So he sent the music to Rye. Next thing I know, I'm having like breakfast with Rye in Highland Park, and he's saying he wants to make my record, which is crazy. So like, that was a big turning point. But again, still working a full-time job. Like, I asked my boss if I could take a week off to record a record with Rye Cooter. And that was exactly 4 years ago. That was in October of 2014. So again, still at my job, working away. I kind of begged Michelle Aquilato to manage me. So she started helping out on the management side, which, you know, got me plugged into some different things. But I think it was like, I got an opportunity to open for Justin Townes Earle in Australia in April of 2015. Mm-hmm. And so that's when I was like, I think I should quit my job because I don't think I'm going to be able to sustain, you know, continuing to ask for time off.
Yep.
And like going on tour, then coming back. And so, but it was tough because, like, unlike a lot of musicians where like maybe they work this kind of like demeaning job, you know, like bussing tables, or they're at a cafe, like as a barista, like I had like a mostly good career. Like,
right.
I was mostly autonomous. I only had to go in the office every once in a while. I was making way more money than I ever thought I would make. So that was like, it was hard to let go of that, you know, because you basically have, you have all of the things that society kind of encourages you to have, which is, again, autonomy, independence, or at least a version of it. And even though you're not fulfilled creatively, well, maybe that doesn't matter because the money's so good and you can just like music in your own time and you know, gig on the weekends. So after, again, I probably started playing out in Long Beach in like 2009. So now I'm 5 years into just kind of like playing shows every once in a while for local audiences. Finally, I'm like, okay, I think this is going to be a real thing. So I think there was a couple like turning points, but getting the chance to make a record with Rye Cooter, that was a huge one. I think that was when it was like, it kind of dawned on me, like, if this guy believes in me and these other people will do, then maybe I should be willing to take a little more risk, you know,
yeah,
for my own self. So that was a big milestone. And then again, when I got offered that tour in Australia, we decided to release the record a couple months early in Australia to coincide with that tour with Justin. And that was also when I decided to quit my job. So that was 4.5 years ago, or no, 3.5 years ago. Yeah. Cause it was like March, April, 2015.
That must have been when you and I first met. Cause I remember I met you just when you were starting, like you had just quit your job around that time.
Okay.
So
I mean, I'm trying to think when I would have played San Francisco. I know I did like a, where did we first meet? Was it one of my gigs or was
no,
it?
No, that Pandora.
That's right.
Yeah.
So that was when the tour started, I think. So that would have been in like June of 2015.
Yeah, that sounds right. Yeah.
Yeah. So I got back from Australia, released the record in the US and started touring on it and had no idea how to tour or what I was doing. And oh my God, that was a very difficult time in my life.
Oh,
it was also because it was also like the craziest thing was, you know, when I was kind of like, okay, I want to go pursue my dreams. But, you know, I told my wife, like, I don't want you to not also pursue your dreams. So like, what do you want to do? And she grew up with horses and she loves horses and she's amazing with them. I mean, whether it's riding horses or getting lessons or taking care of horses. So she's like, well, that's something I'd like to get closer to. I said, well, I'm going to be gone for a long time starting in like May. I said, is there a ranch that maybe you could get a job working on a ranch? And so sure enough, she found this beautiful ranch in Du Bois, Wyoming. And so we put all of our stuff in storage. We quit our respective jobs, put all of our stuff in storage, moved out of our house, and put a few things in her dad's apartment, which is like where we figured we would stay if we needed like a... So, but it was great. We just put all of our stuff in storage. She went and moved to Wyoming to be there for like 3 months to work as a ranch hand.
I love this. Yeah.
On a dude ranch. And I set off in this shitty 15-passenger van with my friends to go play music for like very small crowds of people for several months. And I was away from my wife for 2 6-week stretches where we didn't see each other 6 weeks in a row twice.
Mm.
So it was horribly difficult. I was under so much stress. And all the while people are saying like, oh, congratulations, man, you're really doing it. And it's all, you know, because if someone sees that you get written up in like the Wall Street Journal, well, then, oh, you've made it. You know,
from the outside, it feels that way. But, you know, meanwhile, you're dealing with.
And that's probably always the case whenever the optics are good. You know, And don't get me wrong, you want people to think you're doing well. It's not like you want them to be perceive you as like a loser. But people don't understand, or some people don't understand, that even when there's press and those things are happening, it doesn't mean you're selling out like 5,000 cap clubs. You know, like I hit the road to tour for the first time, not opening for really anyone. I mean, we had a few shows opening with Dawes, which was great. And before that, and I got to open some shows for like Clint Black and some for Dwight Yoakam. So there was a little of that, but for the most part, I was just set loose to like headline my own shows across a country of people that had just barely even heard that I exist. So the genesis of the whole thing was sort of romantically cool and optically successful, but it was an incredibly difficult, challenging, and sometimes very painful part of my life. And again, I wouldn't trade it. You know, I wouldn't trade it for anything, but it was tough.
Yeah. I know. I actually remember talking to you during that time and you talking about being away from your wife for so long and how tough that was. So,
I mean, it's your person, you know, it's your partner.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. But I think it's such a beautiful model of like, you know, the fact that I think artists, true artists, you know, you can't ignore that thing inside you that's just kind of screaming to kind of come out and right. You know, live in that authenticity. And I thought, you know, the way you describe your story about, you know, doing this job that was really cushy and all that, but, you know, just something inside you just couldn't continue doing just that because you had something else you really needed to put out. And I think it's great. It's also encouraging probably for people to hear that you did it sort of a smart way. You know, you didn't just like, because I think you're right. It's like, you know, I'm one of these people that really does take crazy risks and just trust, you know, the universe is going to help meet me. It always has worked out for me. But, you know, I've had people say to me, because I talk about it a lot, and people will be like, oh, you inspire me. I'm quitting my job and I'm doing this. I'm like, oh, my God, no. Like, you know, think it through a little bit first and have a plan, you know, and I think that, I mean, I say no. I mean, yes, do it, but do it thoughtfully too, you know?
Yeah. And we had a plan, but I mean,
right.
You know, it was still, I mean, and still is, you know, I mean, you see my shows, obviously the crowds have grown and there's been some nice success and milestones, but I mean, it's still pretty like month to month.
Right.
I mean, again, a lot of that is just because it's 2018.
Yeah.
And like trying to sustain, you know, a life for myself and my family as a songwriter. I mean, just, it's hilarious. It's like, I mean, to me, like the only things that are crazier than this is like maybe trying to either be an actor or be like a stand-up comedian. You know, it's just like, it's pretty bonkers.
Yeah.
But yeah, again, so that the beginning of it was really tough, and that is when I met you. I remember that. And yeah, I've been around the world many times since then. I feel like I've learned a lot about myself and what I can handle, what I can't handle, what I need to have a successful tour and to make records. And so I feel lucky, but oh my God, that beginning, that was really challenging.
I can't imagine it wouldn't be. I mean, there's just so much, you know, at stake, and just, you know, dealing with, you know, just getting married and having just this time of your life. That's just,
when I came home, right when, pretty much when Andy was finishing up at the ranch, I went out to visit her the second time, is when she got pregnant.
So, right.
So that was the other thing. It was like, and I got another tour in Australia. So I think we found out, like, we went to play Americana Fest in 2015 in Nashville, and like the day or two before, we found out that she was pregnant. And then she went to Australia with me and was pregnant while we were out there. But oh my God, that was when everything really changed again, was when, oh my God, we're gonna have a kid.
Yeah.
What are we gonna do?
Gonna be a dad too. It's like a whole other role in my life now.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness. Yeah.
I have to say though, it's so like, it just made my heart so happy when you were talking about, you know, the fact that you decided to really just like go for, you know, towards what was really calling you. And then you encouraged your wife to do the same thing. And even though you guys were apart, the fact that you were really supporting each other and that is just so beautiful.
And it was so cool to see her in action. I mean, I would go visit her and I'd be like just dead from touring. I'd go out there and kind of be dead for the first day or two. And then I would kind of get it together and I would go with her on rides and I would watch her lead. Like, I mean, this was the second longest ride of the week. Was a 7-hour ride, and she would lead these rides. So she's leading, you know, the guests on horseback through the wilderness of Wyoming.
Wow.
For 7 hours.
Wow.
Like, how the hell do you even know where you are?
Gosh,
for what you're
amazing.
Doing? And so I would be trailing behind on my horse, just kind of in awe and also just like so confused as to how she could even do such a thing. Right. But so that was really good for us, for me to get to see her in her element.
Totally. Yeah.
And that was like falling in love with someone all over again.
Oh, yes. I got the chills. It's just so beautiful. You know, like, I just think that's the best kind of, partnership, is to have two people really, just two independent people doing what they love and what they're like, just being themselves, then coming together and supporting each other. And I mean, that's exactly what I would want in my, future partners. So I think that's inspiring.
And what's funny is that in so many ways, it was one of the most painful times of our relationship, because being away from someone for that long is not, I mean, maybe a couple weeks, two, three, like after the 3, 4, 5 week mark, you just start drifting apart. So we had to like learn about ourselves and what we could handle, and it was good for us, but oh my God, it was tough.
Oh man.
But you made it through. Amazing. And then and then you have a kid, and then that's a whole new atomic bomb on your whole notion of marriage and relationships, and oh my goodness. So it's just all these stages. It's funny to like, you don't really have any context. Like when you hit the new stage, you can sort of like learn from the previous stage and take that into the next one, but certain things are just like pretty much blazing totally new territory. So, but again, I'd rather have this than, I guess, a more boring life. So
yeah, you have a very exciting life, you know. So
It's not always exciting by any means, but it's definitely for the most part not been boring.
Yeah,
for sure.
Right. So I want to touch on you. We were talking a little bit about opening for legendary artists, and I think you, out of like most people, I don't know, I just don't know anyone else has opened or shared the stage with as many legendary artists in the country, Americana field, as you. And so I wanted to talk about that a little bit. And if you could maybe describe one or two just real pinch me moments that you've had. I feel you also have a lot of strong support from a lot of these legends, what that's felt like for you.
Sure. I mean, like you said, there's anytime you get to open a show, you should be grateful, because that person and his people, his or her people, are, sort of saying, we support you and we want to give you this shot to try to bring your music to our fans. So I think whenever you're opening for someone, you need to be grateful for that moment. I think one of the biggest ones for me, maybe not a name that a ton of people are familiar with compared to like maybe like a big country star today, but someone that I find to be sort of like a musical idol, is this band Asleep at the Wheel. Mm-hmm. And they are a band that, I guess, kind of their heyday was in like the early 70s. There were these Western swing revivalists and really kind of the only country band that I grew up listening to. So my dad was obsessed with Asleep at the Wheel, which is led by this amazing singer-songwriter named Ray Benson. Mm-hmm. This like 7-foot-tall dude who was convinced to move to Austin, Texas by Willie Nelson. And so he set up shop in Austin and has been based out of Austin since like the 70s. But I got to do some shows with them, and that was just a dream come true. Because, if it wasn't for me growing up at a young age listening to those records that they made, I don't think there would have been the necessary soil for me to kind of fall in love with country music like I did in my early 20s. So if it wasn't for Asleep at the Wheel, I would not be playing music, at least not like this. I wouldn't be doing that now. So I have them to thank for that. And, when I got to play those shows with them, I talked to Ray and hung out with them, and just such a sweet guy and really humble guy, family guy who speaks very highly of his family. And I've fortunately now also got to become friends with his son. He has a couple sons. One of them's named Sam, who I believe manages the band. And he has another son named Aaron, who I became friends with in LA. So, that's pretty cool. Not only getting to open those shows for someone that you just admire so much, but then getting to kind of befriend them a little bit and then get to know their families is pretty unbelievable. I think one of the happiest shows for me too were like the shows I got to do with Kacey Musgraves.
Oh,
just because her and her band are so incredibly talented. And we got to play, we got to open for a Greek Theater in LA, which was like a total dream come true. I got to open a show for Sheryl Crow one time in Knoxville, Tennessee, and that was the coolest, just because her and her band are so incredibly talented and lovely and sweet, and Sheryl just goes up there and she puts all of her heart into those songs. I mean, she performs those songs. I mean, some of them have been hits for like 30 years, and she performs them like she wrote them like the day before,
Wow, yeah.
So that's inspiring, just to see someone who's kept it together through kind of the heyday of radio hits in the 90s, you know, and her not sort of losing the plot and being able to sustain a very respectable and very impressive career for several decades. I mean, I've only been doing this for 3.5 years, and it's draining and difficult, and it feels like a roller coaster. So I cannot imagine someone in her shoes has seen and what she's gone through. So for someone like that to come out the other end of it, still talented, still hardworking, still humble, and still kind, that's very inspiring. Those are a few that stand out to me.
Totally. Yeah. I remember, and you really like Mary Chapin, right? Mary Chapin Carpenter.
Oh, yes. I got to hang with her too. She is so cool. But yeah, we cover Mary Chapin Carpenter's songs all the time. I love her.
Yeah. Remember I texted her when, cause I used to work with, I worked with her for a little bit, yes. And she's wonderful. And I think I told her, like, oh, you're going to be playing with Sam, or, you know, whenever you guys are playing together. And she sent me a picture of you two, which was so sweet.
That's right. Yeah. I wonder if that's when we were hanging out in London. That might have been when we were hanging out in London, or I'm not sure though.
Yeah, it was a great picture though, wherever it was.
Yeah, she's so cool, man. She's just like so unassuming. And again, it's crazy to think about, you know, there being a time in you know, history where there was real money to be made in the music industry.
Right.
Like you could make records and sell records. It's just so crazy to think about people selling records.
I know.
And she was part of that whole thing. Yep. And I literally own her CDs, and they are in my house right now.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah. That's so, it is crazy to think about. You and I were both, I think we're the same age actually.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, right.
I'm
82.
I'm 36.
Yeah. So am I. We're both Leos too. I remember this. So. We're like,
oh,
really,
your birthday?
August 6th. You're in July, right?
July 28th. July 28th.
I don't know why I remember that, but I remember you and I are very close in that. So we were, you know, kind of coming up at the same time, and in college the same time, when, you know, studying the same things about music and so anyways. okay, so I wanted to switch gears a little bit and talk about mental health a little, because I know it's something that you and I, and if, you know, whatever you're comfortable sharing, you don't need to.
Sure, of course.
But I know, I feel like almost every time we hang, we talk about, because, you know, our shared anxiety and depression things.
Yep.
And somehow I remember having a really long conversation with you about it over tacos, I think at the chapel. Which is just,
I mean, what a more appropriate meal than some good Bay Area tacos.
Exactly.
To talk
in the
about
mission.
Our mutual struggles with anxiety and depression.
Yep. So I guess I just wanted, you know, whatever you're comfortable speaking on that topic, just talk a little bit about how that's touched you and your life and how you've moved through it.
Sure. Well, I mean, I guess to give a little background, you know, my mom passed away a few years ago, and she didn't pass away from necessarily mental illness, but she did struggle with some mental illness. I won't give the whole story because it would kind of take a while, but my best guess towards the end is that, I mean, a lot of the symptoms looked like something sort of like bipolar or maybe borderline personality disorder.
Yep.
So I became aware of, I guess, like, really, where do I begin? So up until really my mid-20s, I experienced more or less kind of an idyllic life. I had like a really good childhood, good adolescence. I started noticing problems with my mother, and then between my mother and my father, when I went away to college and would come home and visit, and things kind of deteriorating, got worse and worse. But right when I was like 25, I got married for the first time. By the time I was 28, I experienced the dissolution of my own marriage at a very young age. And then at that same exact time, my mom was mentally, physically deteriorating really badly, and my parents were divorcing. So I was going through my own divorce. I was watching my mom sort of physically and mentally just kind of unravel. And then also seeing my parents' marriage of over 30 years completely unravel as well. So it was a difficult time. And, you know, I was raised in a conservative Christian home where, you know, you kind of, when you have struggles, you pray and ask God to help you. And that's supposed to sort of do the trick, among other things, you know, but basically, like, if you pray and ask God for help, then he'll help you. And I guess when I was probably 26, 27, for the first time, I started experiencing panic attacks. and didn't really know what was going on. And by the time I was in the throes of my own divorce, I started getting kind of bad, and I was going to therapy, my therapist, but a bit, long story short, I ended up going to a doctor, and he told me, yeah, this is a panic attack.
Right, because you think there's something physically wrong with you. You're like, what's going on?
Yeah, like, so for folks who don't know, if you've not experienced a panic attack, I'm so jealous of you.
Yep, me
but
too.
A panic attack is basically kind of like your body gives itself a shot of adrenaline, similar to when, let's say, you're faced with like a wolf in the wilderness, and there's kind of the fight or flight thing, and adrenaline is supposed to help get us through those tough things. And what's happening is kind of your body getting a shot of adrenaline, even though there is no wolf and there is no shark attack and there is no car accident. You're just sitting by yourself on your computer trying to have a coffee in a cafe. So it's really scary because your heart rate goes up. You feel like you can't breathe. Different people experience different symptoms.
Yeah.
You might feel like you're going to pass out. You just feel the sense of deep terror and dread.
Yep.
And what compounds the terror and dread is kind of like knowing that there's nothing dreadful or terrifying right in front of you. So what the hell is going on that you're fearing the terror and dread? So millions and millions and millions of people experience this, but insanely still in 2018, it's still not exactly, I mean, I feel like panic attacks and anxiety are getting more in you know,
right,
seeping into the cultural zeitgeist of the discussion. But so I started experiencing that. I went and got a prescription for Xanax, which is like the best drug in the universe, because you can take a half a Xanax or Xanax, whatever, and that panic attack will subside. And then on top of that, I also started meditating. I also started, you know, continued with therapy, but I tried to give myself some tools because I was terrified. My mom also struggled with pill addiction, which she kept secret from us for decades. So I'm kind of like, and like growing up, you know, in public schools, we had DARE, you know.
Oh yeah, I remember DARE.
So I'm like thoroughly terrified of becoming addicted to drugs.
Yeah.
So even though I have this prescription, I try to use it sparingly. But that made a big difference in just knowing that if I'm on a plane going somewhere and I get hit with a panic attack, instead of feeling anticipatory anxiety in my body all day going, oh, when you get on the plane, you're going to have a panic attack.
Yep.
What happens, you know, all that anticipatory anxiety, if I keep Xanax with me, it's nice, because then if I do experience panic attack, which I almost never do now, but if I do, I can take a Xanax and it goes away. Anyway, but so really it was when I was 27, 28, all these things were happening and I had to get better. And it was really hard, and I dealt with times of not only anxiety, obviously, but depression, and you know, I still do from time to time. And what sucks is when you're going through a wave or a season of depression, the trick that it plays on you is it tricks you into thinking this is your life now.
Yep, yep.
This is how it's always going to be, and you'll maybe every once in a while get vaguely better, but you are now a depressed person and that's just how it's going to be. So get used to it. And that is simply not fucking true.
Yep.
And so I've had to try to retrain my brain with the help of professionals as well as friends and family, and also bringing in elements of my own Christian faith. But I've retrained my brain to say, no, you are going through a time of depression right now, but this is not forever. And it's amazing though, how real it feels and how the strange prison you feel like you're in the middle of it.
Totally.
And then when it passes, you look back, you're like, oh yeah, what did I ever feel depressed?
That
you
is know, it's so like, it's true. Like, yeah.
It's almost like when you're physically ill, let's say you get like a flu,
yeah,
a stomach bug, and you're like leaning over the toilet, barfing your brains out, and it's miserable. And you're just like, God, this is the worst thing that's ever happened to me ever. Will I please ever get better? This is the, and then like a day later when it's gone, you're like, oh yeah, I think I was sick yesterday, you know?
Yep.
So I've struggled with it. I definitely see similarities between myself and my mother. I'm pretty sure my mom, what happened with her is that she started experiencing anxiety and depression probably at quite a bit younger age. My guess is that maybe even as early as her early teens and into her 20s, and then had a kind of a string of difficult experiences and relationships. Then she married my father when she was 29 and my dad was 22.
Wow.
And she had a 10-year-old kid at that point who my dad raised as his own son. But kind of when my dad came along, she started having kids with him. He was this good kind of Catholic kid, and he had a big family. And I think it kind of like, she just kind of said to herself, I'm okay now, and this is the new me. But then when the depression and stuff started creeping back in, and then she started like medicating it in not healthy ways. Basically, I think my mom's sort of depression and anxiety went so untreated and actually exacerbated that it grew into other things, symptoms of schizophrenia, bipolar, and paranoid personality disorder, and borderline personality disorder. So basically, my mom was amazing. She was the most charismatic, beautiful, loving, just incredible person in the whole world. She almost had like a sixth sense. People felt like she really knew them when she would talk to people.
Yeah. She sounds like an empath. Have you heard about this term?
Yes, of course I have. Yeah. I think she was. And I think with people like that, that are sensitive and that are special like that, I think having those special things can also come with its own set of special demons.
Absolutely.
And I just don't think she knew what to do about it. And yeah. I don't think, again, I can still consider myself a Christian. I don't really go to church, but I still consider myself a Christian. I have faith and I pray and I believe in God and I believe in grace and help and all those things. But I don't think that that's the only tool available to folks that are struggling with depression and anxiety. I think what I see is such a sad thing is still even today in modern churches is that anxiety and depression are still treated like they'll say it's a spiritual problem, like
right.
spiritual warfare, like the devil's coming after you, as though the devil gives a shit about you. Like if there really is a devil, some like housewife in Chardon, Ohio, like that's his top priority for the, you know, like, so,
right,
so
right.
I think she struggled with a lot of things, didn't quite know how to deal with it, and at the same time was also high functioning. Like my parents were always kind of like the sort of unofficial like marriage counselors, and whatever church we were going to, they would lead home groups, they would counsel other married couples all the time. So they're these sort of high functioning people who put all of their eggs in the Bible basket. And then when shit started really hitting the fan between themselves, they didn't get any help. They didn't go to therapy. They didn't go to my mom, instead of trying, you know, real sort of, I guess, intense and regular psychotherapy, just started taking more painkillers. So again, this is not to throw anyone under the bus. My parents did the best they could. My dad's a wonderful man. I'm still very close with and love deeply. And my mom was an incredible person. But if you are struggling with mental stuff, that is its own thing.
Yeah.
And that has a specific doctor called either a psychiatrist or a psychologist. So I think for me, it's like, I would encourage people, if you are struggling with depression and anxiety, you know, certainly go to your friends, certainly go to your pastor if you have a good pastor, certainly go to your, you know, the mentors, but there is a specific type of person to help you with that.
Sure.
And it's called a therapist.
Yeah.
And cognitive therapy was greatly effective for me making sense of why sometimes my brain and my thoughts get caught in a negative feedback loop,
yeah.
and what I can do to combat those things when they appear. So now when I struggle with depression, anxiety, which I still do from time to time, or when I have friends that do, I remind myself, dude, this is just right now, or maybe this is just today, or this is this week. This is not your life forever.
Yeah.
You're not going to be in this forever.
It's,
So, you know, I think my mom really needed someone to help her and not just tell her to like ask God for help or to curse the devil or curse demons or something. Like maybe it's demons doing it, but probably fucking not. It's probably a genetic situation
that
we are all deeply affected by because our ancestors were deeply affected by it.
Absolutely. I think you just described depression and anxiety in the most kind of truthful way that I think I've ever heard it, really. Like that, it resonated so deeply. And, you know, talking about your mom being such an empath and sensitive being, and I really do think it goes hand in hand, you know, having that is a beautiful gift to have, but it's also, you know, it's also really tough on the person who has that. And I think
it's really tough. It's a burden.
Yeah, it's a burden. Yeah. Yeah.
And it can even feel like a curse sometimes.
Totally. You know? And I think this is why like 98% of my friends are artists, you know, in some ways,
right.
because like all of us are that way, you know,
right.
have that like hyper sensitivity, you know,
yeah.
And which is a beautiful thing, like we said, but can be so freaking difficult sometimes. And I was going to ask you, you know, what I've been asking all my guests on this show and the podcast is, you know, what's in your toolkit to help you move through these things, these bouts of whatever, depression or anxiety. And you really just answered it in the best way, I think. It's just kind of reminding yourself that, that it's temporary. And that's, it's like you said, it's hard to believe it. And when you're in it,
but yeah.
It's,
and I would say, you know, a big thing I've learned, and it's hard to admit to yourself, but if you're drinking too much, then stop.
Sure. Yeah.
Because you can be a pretty healthy person, but if depression, anxiety starts creeping in and you try to medicate in it with the wrong stuff, such as booze or recreational drugs that otherwise, like when you're 23, smoking weed every night, no problem. But then when you're 33 or whatever, and you start struggling with depression, pot is maybe not the answer.
Right.
For some people that might be. I'm not saying it's not for some people. But for me, I've also just noticed that really taking it easy on booze has also helped me tremendously in staying out of those seasons of darkness. So that has also been a big thing. And again, I love to drink. I think I'm not gonna probably ever be like 100%, you know, thing where I just never drink anything, never have a drop. But learning to hit that stuff in much more mediation has been a huge help to me.
Awesome. Yeah, I don't really drink much, but hardly ever actually, for no particular reason. But, you know, so many of my friends and family, I know when they lay off drinking for a while, it helps with their depression. So,
yep.
So, yep, it's a good tool there.
Yep.
And do you feel like, I mean, we've talked a lot about this. We don't have to get too much into it. But for me, I know that anxiety is sort of like my constant companion, you know, it's always there. And depression just sort of comes and goes like a visitor sometimes. But has it been like that for you too? And you mentioned the anxiety, the panic attacks. Is it just sort of there or not really? Is it just kind of pop up?
You know, there have been times where it is a constant companion.
Yeah.
These days, I mean, depends, to be honest. Like, you know, again, being a songwriter in 2018, it just means you're not making the money that you'd probably want to be making, unless you're really crushing. So I think I deal with anxiety more like around certain sort of like bread and butter situations, like, do we have enough money to pay the bills
today? Yeah.
Or, you know, my baby's coming. Am I going to be able to handle having another kid?
Mm-hmm.
Does my wife still love me even when I'm gone? Mm-hmm. You know, those sorts of things. But for the most part, I feel like I've gotten through the super intense, like constant anxious thing.
Mm-hmm.
I still from time to time wake up. I call morning anxiety, where you wake up, heart beating about stuff you need to take care of.
Yeah.
And then there's also, I don't know if you've heard this term, but the noonday demon.
No, I haven't heard
this.
This
sort of like shitty anxiety that seems to always happen around lunchtime.
Interesting.
So that stuff still happens to me fairly regularly. And then if it does happen, let's say I get the noonday demon thing, I feel like usually by like 2 or 3, that's pretty much subsided. Honestly, for me, hitting the booze too much and also just getting regular exercise, those things have kept me out of like kind of like that code red,
right?
Sort of constant. But yeah, I mean, again, it's still I'm in an entertainment industry. The success and failure of what you do is not obviously just based on whether or not you've got the talent, but it's so much based on who people feel like talking about from month to month, what's going to be popular and what the trends are. I mean, I've had nights where I feel like I'm on top of the world. I feel like everyone loves me. All of my colleagues look up to me and I've really made it. And then I have days where like, okay, like 2 years ago, I mean, I'll just tell you the story because it's so damn funny. I feel like the way that it happened. So this was in spring of 2000 and, oh, no, I guess this was last year's story. This is last year, spring of 2017.
Yeah.
I'm about to release a new album and I go to England to kind of do a press tour in the UK. And I'm out there, I get to bring my wife and my baby with me. And I'm just feeling, you know, I go around, I play different shows, do radio stuff, interviews, doing all this stuff. And I'm feeling so much love. And I come home just kind of beaming, you know, but it's a long day. But by the time you go from your hotel, so if you're in London, you gotta get from London to LA, here's what happens. You wake up a billion years before your flight, to get all your shit together,
right.
To get your baby dressed, right? Get your baby shit together. You get in the cab and it takes 3 million years to get to the train station. Then you take a 45-minute express train to the airport. Then it takes forever to get checked in. Then you get on your plane and it takes 11 hours to fly from London to LA. Then you get to LA, it takes forever to get through security, forever to get your bags. Then you get an Uber and it takes an hour to get from the Uber. So by the time I get home, like my wife and I are, we've been awake for a straight day. We're on
oh,
the verge
man.
Of death.
Yes, yes.
But I'm still feeling this buzz from how much love I felt in England. Get home, sit down on the toilet, take a shit, pull up my phone, open up Twitter, and the first thing I see is that I've been listed in the 10 lamest Americana acts by none other than the LA Weekly.
Oh, God.
So after all that love, I get home to my hometown, open up an article where someone is just taking a snarky jab at me because I'm a hipster or some shit or whatever. So like there's those moments where you're just like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
Like
you're on this high and then you just get dropped down.
But not even like a high. Like I just want to like make music.
Yeah.
Like what? And of course you just have, all you can do is laugh it off and get up the next day and do your thing. But it's, there are those times where like something shitty like that will happen, or, you know, I mean, I could go on about stories and things like that, but you have to somehow get through that stuff without it like deeply affecting you.
Yeah, I mean, that's hard.
Really, and again, I'm not telling that story to garner sympathy at all. And plus, my biggest problem with the article is just poorly written. Like, I'm better at talking shit on myself on a regular basis from stage. Like, this dude didn't even try. He basically, his beef was like, I'm a hipster who makes pop music. And I'm like, no shit. Of course, I'm trying to make pop music, and I don't exactly know what a hipster is, but if you're just jealous that I dress better than you, then I can handle that. But, you know, it was just a poorly written article, and I was just bummed. Because if I would have gotten the chance to write a takedown on Sam Outlaw, I would have crushed it.
I think it's just, like, it's hard for me to understand these people that write these articles and that are, like, bashing
well,
people,
we have
you
to,
know? It's like,
I allow for it. I don't want to live in a culture where, you know,
yeah,
we all just agree with each other and everyone's politically.
No, of course.
I'm fine with some shit talking, and I'm fine being the target of it.
But just being mean for the sake of being mean, like, you know,
yes,
I don't
it was
get
just,
that.
But again, on that list was also, like, some people I really love, like Gillian Welch and Jason Isbell and Lucinda Williams. So if those are people,
yeah.
Yeah, I felt like I was going. But, you know, it was just so funny to come, you know, I'm a week in London and all this love. I come home to my hometown and that's the first thing I see.
Man. Yeah, that is, oh, man, I tell you.
It was kind of awesome, though.
It makes for a good story, for sure.
It's, like, so fucked up that you just laugh.
Totally. Ugh. Well, as your friend, I'm like, I don't like hearing that. But,
like even my one precious buddy in Nashville, my buddy Kale, is just so sweet. He like calls me. I think he even called me that. And I'm like, dude, are you okay?
Aww.
And I'm like, yes, Kale, I'm okay.
It's gonna happen. It's inevitable. Yeah. Oh,
like, I could have written it way better, but whatever.
I love that.
And yes, I'm okay.
Okay. So yeah, but I want to just ask you about what two things. One, what your most memorable concert experience has been. You kind of talked a little bit about, you know, favorite memories and pinch me moments,
right.
But is there anything
right.
that stands out to you as a favorite concert moment?
Oh, I mean, there's a few. It's like, which one is, I got to play a festival outside of Madrid, Spain. This was in 2016. And I mean, when I say festival, I mean, there's only three bands that played an evening. And yeah, I got to play for like 5,000 or 6,000 people, and everyone was singing along to one of my songs.
Wow.
I mean, that was just crazy. I remember the first show I ever played in Europe. We played in Gothenburg, Sweden. I was so jet lagged that I was throwing up in the green room. And me and my harmony singer, it was just an acoustic tour. We walked out on the stage to a completely packed house.
Wow.
Hundreds and hundreds of people in a town never played before. And the sickness kind of went away. And I just played. I mean, it probably wasn't even a very good show, but the audience was so incredible that it made it feel like it was the best show I've ever played. You know, you feel like so I mean, there's just these moments where sometimes you just feel so blown away that you get to do this, you know, like you, because of some song you wrote in your bedroom, whatever, 4 years ago, you're now getting to be in Spain or in Norway or in France or in Germany or in Los Angeles or in San Francisco, and you get to stand up in front of anybody and play those songs and they want to hear it. And sometimes they sing along. It's just crazy.
And
it feels,
just take it all in.
Yeah. You try to take it in.
Yeah.
I've there've definitely been a few shows where I've just reminded myself in the middle of the show, like, enjoy this in the moment.
Mm.
This is supposedly why you're doing this. So don't just skip over it, you know?
Yeah. I think that's so important, you know, just back to the mental health thing, is to just spend time cultivating and appreciating, just being grateful, you know, and that's right. It just reminds you of like, man, this is an amazing life, you know?
Yeah. That's not easy to, it's not easy to be present, which is obviously, yeah. I think, you know, meditation, and I use like the Headspace app, and that's definitely helped me just to learn about being mindful. And again, I'm so impatient. I'm the classic like type A multitasking person. So just to be calm and to be present is like the opposite of my intrinsic personality.
Right.
But meditation's helped me to learn that, and just getting my ass kicked touring for the last 3 years has also taught me that.
Awesome. Okay, Sam. So finally, I just want to ask you a couple of your favorite things that feed your soul. All right. Ooh, so I'm just going to go through. All right. So how about a song or album?
Oh my God, that's so tough.
I know. It can just be a one, not B.
Of course. Even still, you're like, what is the thing? Right. I mean, a huge one for me is Emmylou Harris' Wrecking Ball.
Mm.
I feel like I go back to that one so much. When I was going and visiting Andy in the ranch, Wyoming, I would listen to it on the drive out and back. And I would be sometimes weeping because I'd be either on my way to see her and out of my mind, or be on my way out from just leaving her and I'd be out of my mind. But there must be something about that music that reaches me, because it seems to be a go-to album for me in times of distress and in times of peace. So that's a big one.
Awesome. Okay. How about a favorite place?
What's my favorite place? You know, my family still for the most part lives in San Diego. Mm. I think I feel a sense of calm when I get to go there. I think especially now that we've, I guess, technically moved away from Southern California, at least for a time, you just miss family so much.
Yeah.
And I think being down in San Diego, you know, it is where I grew up. I moved there when I was 10. So I think San Diego is a big one, just because my sister's there and her kids, and my brother and his wife and his kids, and my dad is there. So that's one.
Awesome.
Nothing to do with music, just being with my family.
Yeah. Awesome. I mean, it's good to have places that kind of you feel bring you back to your kind of core self, you know. And
that's right.
Yeah. Awesome. Okay. How about a favorite book?
Ooh, favorite book. Bukowski, Ham on Rye is one of my favorites. Mm. John Steinbeck, East of Eden is one of my favorites. Two very, very, classic. Very, very different stories.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, Ham on Rye just kind of makes me cry and makes me laugh so hard. Mm. I think that's so cool when a book can do that. And East of Eden just makes me wish that I was a writer.
Oh, yeah, he's an amazing. Have you read some of the letters he would write? There's this one letter that he wrote to his son when his son was falling in love for the first time. It's one of my favorite letters of all times.
Yeah. No.
I'll send it to you. It's beautiful. I will.
Oh my God. I'll probably just cry the entire
time. Yeah.
Any father son stuff now. I lose it.
Oh yeah. Yeah. You have to get this book. It's like a collection of letters that he wrote, and it's just, I love it. And then how about a favorite podcast? If you listen to podcasts.
I do. I mean, I can't believe I got to be a guest on this podcast, because I'm the biggest fan. It's so insane. But
mine? Just kidding.
Yes. Now this is another one.
Just teasing.
But the Bret Easton Ellis podcast.
I don't know that one.
Yeah. So okay, Bret's obviously an author. Like, he wrote American Psycho and Less Than Zero.
Oh, yes.
But his podcast, I mean, it's not for everybody. I'll just tell you, he's an eccentric, interesting person who is not afraid to speak his mind. And a lot of his thoughts kind of fly directly in the face of our current culture. But I don't always agree with him, but I love that he speaks his truth.
Mm.
And he has really cool guests on there. I'm probably the least famous guest he's ever had by far. but I got to be a guest, and actually we're technically now kind of buddies. Every once in a while I get to have dinner with Bret Easton Ellis, which is kind of cool.
Awesome.
But yeah, his podcasting is amazing. I also love Serial. That was I got obsessed with that. I love Alec Baldwin's podcast. Uh-huh. Here's the thing.
Yep.
I love the country music podcast, Cocaine Rhinestones. And Tyler Coe is now a buddy of mine. I keep becoming friends with podcasters.
That's great.
Weird.
That's awesome.
I wish you could become friends with Alec Baldwin too. I don't know. Maybe that's
put it out there. Now yeah, it's spoken.
There.
So
put it out there, Alec. Love you. Love what you do.
Awesome. Cool, Sam. Well, thank you so much for doing this.
Oh, it's
so good to chat, and miss you. I love you, and can't wait to see you soon. Hopefully,
you're one of the sweetest, most genuine people I've ever met, and it's my pleasure to be involved in anything you do. So, thank you so much.
Musings with Monse, artists and their honest stories, is audio produced by the amazing Aaron Mooring. And the beautiful theme music you hear is by Heather Maloney.